Hello. I'm calling you back to order. That means you listen. Welcome back for the second half. We saved the best for last, right? Maybe? I'm just kidding, Jamie. You were the best. Anyway, so I'm going to read all the bios of our illustrious fiction writers and nonfiction writers, and then they will come up in that order. So for fiction, I keep saying fiction, for prose, our graduate winner for fiction was S.J. Sindhu. S.J. Sindhu's creative writing has appeared in Brevity, The Normal School, The Los Angeles Review of Books, Apt, Vinyl Poetry, Vita, and elsewhere, and her debut novel, Marriage of a Thousand Lies, is forthcoming in 2017 from Soho Press. And our graduate nonfiction winner is Sean Towie, who has published work in Word Riot, The Rumpus, The Newer York, and elsewhere. He's working on a PhD in English and Creative Writing at FSU. He serves as the fiction editor for Bluestem magazine at Eastern Illinois University, and he hopes the magazine will survive the insane budget cuts demanded by the Republican humanoid governor of Illinois. These are his words, but they sound legit. For 4 years, Sean was a Jesuit seminarian training to become a Catholic priest. It didn't work out. He arrived in Tallahassee via Tacoma, Gods County, Washington, and St. Louis, Missouri. And our graduate nonfiction runner-up is Kate Kimball, whose work has appeared in the Hawaii Review, Weber, Ellipsis, Arcadia, and Kestrel, among others. Her novel was a semi-finalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award in 2011, and she has worked over 50 jobs and is from Salt Lake City. That's a lot of jobs. And for undergraduate, our winner in fiction, again, is C.D. Davidson Hears. You already know her. She doesn't need another introduction. And for nonfiction, we have Jessica Gonzalez, who is a senior at FSU and will be graduating in April with a B.A. in English and a double major in communication. She will attend the University of Southern California in the fall to pursue an MFA in screenwriting. Yay. So we will have S.J. Sindhu read first, and then Sean, Kate, C.D., and Jessica. Clap for them.
As low as it can go. Yeah, this is fine. Okay, so this is the beginning of my short story called Comets Unseen. 4 days before his death, Amit Majumdar files for divorce. He's living in a tiny apartment in Somerville that he's been renting since December, ever since his wife packed a bag full of his clothes and burned it in the backyard of their suburban brick house. Winter has broken, and Somerville's tree-lined streets rupture with color. Pink petals work their way into the cracked, uneven sidewalks. As soon as Amit files for divorce, he calls Hannah. She doesn't pick up. He leaves her a voicemail. "We can be together now," he says. "I love you," he says. "I filed for divorce," he says. But 4 days pass and Hannah doesn't call back. For Amit, the world stops making sense. At 8:10 p.m. on April 15th, a woman named Pamela Robertson will push Amit in front of an Orange Line train at the Forest Hills T stop in Boston. She will be frustrated, and all it'll take is a little shove, a couple of pounds of pressure. Amit will already be over the line, standing with his toes butting into the yellow markings on the platform. He will lean forward, looking into the tunnel as the headlights fill the empty stone void, the light rushing closer, and Pamela will put out her arm and shove him in the back, her fingernails scraping against his trench coat, and he will hang there, poised between death and the platform, slanted. Pamela will be able to picture it years later, the way his body will hang diagonal between the platform and the yellow line, the way the tunnel will fill with light, the way the rumbling train will carry him off like a leaf. When police officers ask her why she did it, she won't tell them. Pamela will feel her skin, the clothes over them, the air around her and the officers. This is what she will know. That she has a chip in one of her nails from the machines at Tony's chocolate factory where she works. That there are 1.82 ounces of white chocolate in each almond macaroon they make. That she needs her roots touched up where the gray is starting to shine. That her appointment is on April 16th at 4 p.m. with Amanda. That she is wearing the wrong type of shoes. That for her flat feet, she should really wear sneakers when she stands at the machines all day, but she can't bring herself to give up her polished leather penny loafers like the ones her mother used to wear. On the morning of his death, Amit heaves himself out of bed and turns on the tiny TV in his tiny Somerville apartment. The red line train rumbles beneath the floorboards. He looks around and thinks that he needs to get a clock. He could get some plants or a picture frame to hang over the white spot on the wall where someone had patched over a hole and neglected to paint it. He could make a home here. He could be happy. He could take his kids to Boston on the weekends, buy them food in Chinatown, watch all the parades and shows they had missed before when the thought of driving to Boston on the weekends exhausted him. Amit wants to sink down into the weary mattress springs, down through the floorboards and into the earth. He wonders how things went so wrong. Something had burned off his childhood optimism like fog in the sun. He and Hannah had fought viciously the last time he'd seen her, their biggest fight in the 2 years they'd been dating. "Do you love me like you loved your wife?" That had been the question, a trick question, he has since realized. A question to which his answer of, "First love only happens once," had been the wrong thing to say. Hannah hasn't talked to her own mother for 3 years because they disagreed over her father's funeral arrangements, though Hannah hadn't told Amit the details. He knows Hannah can hold a grudge. Amit reheats the naan and palak paneer left over from his takeout dinner at the Indian place down the street. The palak paneer tastes like the styrofoam cup he heated it in, but he eats it anyway. On April 15th, Pamela calls her daughter Hannah before work. She calls her daughter every day before work, though Hannah hasn't picked up for over 3 years. Pamela says the same thing into the voicemail that she does every day. "I miss you. Call me. Your father and I love you." Pamela's husband has been dead 3 years of a heart attack. Her daughter had walked out of the funeral and hasn't spoken to her since. Pamela wraps her green paisley scarf around her neck, slips her feet into her shiny leather penny loafers, and steps outside. She makes sure to lock the deadbolt on her apartment door. She walks down the stairs of her condo building, her knees creaking with every step. Maybe it's time to move, she thinks. Maybe she should get a nice house without stairs, somewhere outside of town. Newton, Concord even, go north, away from the bustle of the city, north to the sleepy towns where locals in costume still reenact the start of the American Revolution. What would she do in such a town? She's so used to the tea that she knows most schedules by heart. Her feet carry her to where she needs to go without having to think about Boston's winding streets. She likes the chaos, likes that people who have lived in Boston for all their lives can still get lost, likes that she never does. Thank you.
almost at the right height. Very close. Is this okay? Is this clear? I'm reading clearly. This is an abridged version of the essay I wrote. It's called Jesus and Blueberry Cobbler. We gather in cavernous dining rooms. We spread out among the circular tables and watch each other choose seats. The liberals who want women priests and gay marriage and a Catholic church similar to Jesus Christ Superstar do their best to avoid the conservatives who stay up at night reading papal documents and cry after masturbating and stare into the mirror making faces like the saints they see on holy cards. But we all feel guilty about it, this avoidance of the political other, because we know Jesus would never do the same. He would grab a chair next to anyone, and he would love them, and isn't it incredible something as simple as sitting down to dinner reminds us of the disastrous chasms between our personal tiny lives and the life we are trying to follow. I received my acceptance into the Oregon province of the Society of Jesus in early May, and afterward I immediately set about crafting my master plan to get laid one last time before committing myself to a life of never getting laid again. Glenn called me when he heard the news. He had been my spiritual advisor over the last year, and he was the one who told me I'd make a great priest in the first place. In a way, it was all his fault. "Listen, I'm going to tell you something an old Jesuit told me right before I entered," he said. "Something big is going to happen this summer. You're going to get a job offer you don't want to refuse. Maybe you'll fall in love. Whatever it is, it'll be big, and it'll make you think twice about driving down to Portland." "Great," I said. "It is great. It's all a gift. You can call me anytime, and if something big does happen, remember, it's normal." But nothing was normal about what I was doing. In Seattle, there were more white boy Rastafarians from the suburbs than people lining up to become Jesuits. Normal was nowhere in sight. I met Tamara while we were both waiting tables at the old spaghetti factory on Elliott Avenue in downtown Seattle. The brick building squatted in the Space Needle's shadow, the bay a stone's throw from the parking lot. Most of our customers were tourists embarking on two-week Alaskan cruises to see the last of the polar bears hop from one deserted ice floe to another. I introduced myself as Tamara stared into a computer screen, trying to not screw up an order. I found the button she needed and held out my hand. She had beautiful blue eyes, and when she said my name, her Michigan accent stretched the vowels from the consonants. I dropped a breadboard on the shoulder of an unsuspecting child the following night. The Spag's breadboards were thick enough to bludgeon to death all of the world's overweight, diabetic children begging for their 18th refill of strawberry lemonade. His mom was in the bathroom, so I told the kid I'd bring him extra ice cream if he kept his mouth shut. Tamara saw it happen and walked up to me in the kitchen. "I'm pretty sure servers aren't supposed to drop breadboards on kids." "Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure new girls are supposed to keep their mouths shut until they've been here for a while." 2 months later, the weekend before I moved to Portland, I heard Tamara telling the story to my mother. And that's pretty much when I fell in love with him. We stand by our seats and wait for prayer. We hope it will be quick because we are starving. Steam rises from the trays on the buffet line. We eat artisanal salads. We eat string beans prepared in balsamic vinegar. We eat chicken parmesan and flank steaks, and on Fridays during Lent, we eat fried catfish. On the other side of the room, on the buffet table designated for desserts, there is a pan full of fresh blueberry cobbler. Or there is pecan pie, the layer of caramelized sugar coating the dish, the sheer mouth-watering joy of homemade pastries, a poor substitute for the romantic relationships we have forsaken as Catholic seminarians. Instead of sex, we have sweet, sweet apple pie. We make the sign of the cross and bow our heads. Hopefully someone will lead us in the standard prayer every single Catholic has memorized, but no one actually understands. We will say it fast. Blessed is the Lord in these thy gifts which are about to receive from thy bounty through Christ our Lord. Amen. There are some old fathers around us to keep us in line, but the rest of us are training to be priests, so we need to rehearse praying in public. We practice on each other like nursing students sticking needles into the arms of their classmates, blood spurting out of ruptured veins. If a liberal leads prayer, we will ask God to watch over the poor, the homeless, those suffering from mental illness, those suffering from any slights and grievances, real or perceived, all of those suffering from an intolerance to gluten, and for all of the left-handed people across the world without access to left-handed appliances. Once we prayed for all of those with gastrointestinal issues, and some of us thought, "I'm glad I'm not sitting next to that guy tonight." If a conservative leads prayer, we will pray for the Pope, for the bishops, for the preservation of the one most holy Catholic Church, for the unborn, for the strict observance of all 1 million canonical codes, for continued religious freedom, for the conversion of all heathens, and we will watch the blueberry cobbler get cold, and most of us will pray for the prayer to end. Each of us knows, in his own way, there is only one prayer. Thank you. That's it. We receive far more than we deserve, and we are grateful. Tamara spent the night in my apartment the first time because her boyfriend kissed someone else while drunk at a party. We didn't sleep together. Maybe the kiss was the excuse she had been looking for, or maybe she had intended to stay faithful, to only toy with the advances of another man who told her she was gorgeous and tried to dance with her and was entering the seminary. Sometimes we'd get too drunk and argue about why she wouldn't sleep with me, or Catholicism, or about anything to distract us from our panic-stricken love affair. Some nights we yell at each other in the street, cigarette ash falling on our clothes, and I'd walk back to my apartment by myself, the ground tilted 17 degrees to the right, using parked cars to stay upright. She broke up with her boyfriend and moved into a studio apartment not far from where I lived on Capitol Hill. She bought a white cat and named it Marley. We each aimed to sit at a table with a guest, usually some non-Jesuit from the outside world, enjoying the free food and strange company. We call these people externs, as in not one of us. We watch what we say around the externs. We try not to curse or bring up anything disparaging about the Jesuits, like the time some of us were drunk on the back porch late at night and a liberal got into an argument with a conservative about whether waterboarding actually constituted torture. Brian, the conservative, offered to let himself be waterboarded in order to prove it was neither dangerous nor terrifying. Jacob, the liberal, immediately agreed to proctor the experiment. Father Superior came down at 4 a.m, not because of the noise, but because he always woke up that early and found Brian coughing up water on the kitchen floor. Afterward, there was no longer a cachet of whiskey in the alcohol closet. That is the type of thing we do not mention to externs. Guests eat first, which is why we want to sit with them. God forbid we run out of artisanal salad. We stand in line. We rack ourselves with guilt if we take the best piece of steak because it shows selfishness. We castigate ourselves if we take the worst piece of steak because it shows self-pride in our own holiness. And the whole thing becomes this terrible paradox, true versus false humility, and the whir of our cerebral cortex is spinning out of control, buzzes from our ears, and sometimes we need to take a deep breath and relax because we know there is blueberry cobbler. The night before I moved to the seminary, Tamara drove down to Tacoma after her shift. We sat on the back porch with my mom, stepdad, little brother, and smoked pot. Even my stepdad, John, who normally didn't partake, took a hit. He coughed, started sweating, and passed out on the couch. Tamara and I went to bed. Over the summer, I had talked a lot of shit about my sexual expertise, constantly informing Tamara about the great time she was missing. When I came in 30 seconds, it was only fitting. In the morning, I woke up laying next to me, her dark hair covering the pillow. I slipped out of bed and dug a pair of basketball shorts off the floor. John, who never slept more than 3 hours at a time because of his Vietnam injuries, had already made coffee. I stepped outside into a Pacific Northwest dawn, burning the dew off of the deck to smoke a cigarette. "I had a great time with you and Tamara last night. She's a great girl," said John in his upstate New York accent. He sounded like an English-speaking wood chipper. "Yeah, she is. You probably don't want to talk about it. I'll leave you alone." I wasn't allowed to bring my cell phone, so I waited until everyone else was in the seminary was asleep, and I used the phone across the hall from the chapel, the crucifix peering at me through the doorway. For the first week, she picked up every night, and we talked about nothing at all. The second week, we spoke 4 times, quick conversations punctuated by what we weren't telling each other. By the third week, I called 4 times and left 3 messages, each more desperate than the last. None of them returned. And by the fourth week, I had stopped calling. Someone clears the table and pours the coffee. We finally eat that blueberry cobbler. We take turns washing the dishes. Eventually, we exit the dining room to study, to prep, to smoke, to pray, to smoke cigarettes, to write, to watch television. We sleep alone in cold twin beds, staring out from the windows at a moon as alone as ourselves, and though we believe Jesus is with us, the wooden figurine hanging over our desks is a far cry from the heat of another person, a body, a hand across the small of our backs. Those are the difficult times, the dark nights of the soul. In the better times, we think, thank you, for snowed-in nights on a back porch with cheap beer and harmonicas and guitars, singing Closing Time by Semisonic, off-key and hammered, for a love that is unearned and undeserved, given to us because of our existence, for lives shouting out into the wilderness about another way to live, a prism of self-worth based not on our ability to hoard, but our potential to love. We have a long way to go, but we are grateful. Thanks.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to read part of an essay. It's entitled Withheld, a Patient Medical History Questionnaire. And it's written in the format of like one of those annoying patient questionnaires that you fill out rigorously before you go to the doctor's office. So this section is called Present Complaint. I don't know how to tell the truth. Okay, I do, but not really. I mean, I will never lie about big stuff, someone dying so that I can be off work, having a job I don't really have, having an illness I don't have, being from somewhere I'm not. But whenever someone gets close, I find that I start leaving out information and rearranging facts. I don't always consciously do it, but sometimes I question what is real. Everything feels disconnected. My oncologist in Gainesville referred me to a therapist who told me I was in a perpetual power struggle for control of my own story. Even though I dropped out of therapy primarily for financial reasons and because I felt like I was doing something wrong during every session, not talking enough, not being emotional, not engaging with the fear of cancer, etc., and also because I thought it was completely ludicrous, I hung on to this statement and wondered if it had to do with my mother, who still to this day tells me what I am thinking and feeling and what I know to be true. My mother's truth is backed up by our rich pioneer ancestral heritage and her pronounced lineage revealed in the patriarchal blessing she received as a young woman before serving a full-time LDS mission in Central America, as coming all the way back from Joseph, the biblical figure known for his multicolored coat, the lineage of posterity coming from Joseph to his son Ephraim, to a few more biblical figures, to pioneers all the way down to a beloved prophet, Spencer W. Kimball, and is filled with a devout faith in Jesus Christ. Faith that caused my ancestors to sacrifice everything. My mother says we are promised blessings through this lineage that we can't fathom in this life. We will need to wait for the next to sort it all out. My mother says she knows that those blessings are real. But this is real. I have non-Hodgkin's primary cerebral lymphoma, cancer coming from my brain. I need to focus on one complaint, but when it comes to my health, there are many strands. I have diabetes, and before moving to Florida, I had multiple surgeries that resulted in a hysterectomy. When I finally told my mother I couldn't have children, she said that I should have gotten married to in my early 20s and picked up books after. You're too picky, she told me once, and now look, you missed your chance. Because having children is of utmost importance to my mother, she tells me that I could earn 12 PhDs and not know as much as a woman who has had 8 children, such as herself. I find that I cannot be on the phone for very long with her. Sometimes I lie and say that there is someone at the door or that I'm going to class. Sometimes I simply tell her I have to go when she is mid-sentence. My mother says I chose these tests before I came to Earth, and when I first tell her about the cancer, she tells me it is to humble me. Later, she starts fasting and going to the temple, and she reassures me that I will be fine if I repent and focus on my faith and put my priorities in a long line with my religiosity being at the top. My mother tells me I have to do everything to stay alive. I don't tell her that sometimes this feels like too much work. I don't tell her about how, after my second round of chemo, I pulled into a pawn shop and filled out the paperwork to purchase a gun. The pawnbroker, a slightly paunchy man with a sandy-colored beard, pulled a Smith & Wesson M&P, a slightly heavy and sleek handgun he compared to a Glock, from a locked case. He removed the safety and demonstrated different aims, assuring me that it was a great home protection weapon and that he was giving me a deal at $473. Seriously, he said, you can't beat that anywhere. When he passed me the gun, I let it sit in my hands for a moment, taking in the metallic edges, the sleekness, the way that it was easily made invisible. I had never held a gun before, and after attending Virginia Tech right after the largest shooting on a college campus in the United States, I had removed myself from any curiosity in shooting and weaponry altogether. It was just too costly. Now, I cocked the gun back and stopped, waiting a few beats to envision a bullet raging through hair and skin and muscle and bone. I felt a scream in my throat, an explosion of vision and light and emptiness. Even if I went into remission, the cancer would always be there, hanging over me like some oppressive communist rule. I tentatively touched the barrel and waited. Do you want to see another model? The pawnbroker asked. I had felt for a second that I was above myself looking down. I could see the way my hands wrapped around the gun, feeling the pulse of terminality. There were so many loose ends, an apartment without an open lease, close to 100 students between two schools who would need final grades, Shannon who would need someone else to talk to before going to bed every night, and my mother who would never have thought it possible due to her strong faith. What do you think? The man asked again. I don't think it's an option right now, I told him, passing the gun back quickly. It's too expensive, but I'll keep you in mind. Thank you.
Hello again. I think we got lucky again. So this poem, that's not a poem. This story goes through multiple titles, so we'll call it I Feel Pretty. I feel pretty, said a large brown cow with dark dog eyes that was standing at the edge of a field. She was staring outward across an area of sprawling wheatgrass where an interstate balanced on the far side. A tan Abrax steer listed drowsily behind the cow in direct sunlight. His hooves were tucked underneath a muscular barrel. His whiskers tingled from brushing against the heads of grass blades. Muscles in his neck bulged outward when he bobbed his head in acknowledgement, though it was obvious that he wished the brown cow would stay silent. I feel pretty, the brown cow repeated. I've had my tag on for 6 days now. The tan Abrax raised droopy eyelids and mumbled, you mean lucky. His lips parted slightly and his breath rustled against dry stalks of grass. The big brown cow stomped a hoof as a deer fly careened beneath the spaces of her legs. She lowered her head as a semi-truck rumbled past on the interstate, many cars racing behind it as if to vie for its attention. No, I mean pretty, she said slowly. I feel pretty. The brown cow said once more in finality, turning her attention entirely away from the tan Abrax. The conversation between the two had run its course. The tan Abrax went back to dozing quietly. The cow seemed to be counting the inconsistent drone of the cars in the distance. A fly landed on her back and her tail slapped it away. When the sharp clap of a gunshot echoed across the pasture, the tan Abrax blinked his eyes twice and the cow twitched an ear. The brown cow stared through the wire fence at rustling wheatgrass, her mind on verge of asking what the tan Abrax thought of wheat. She pushed against the wire fence. The blue fella won't like that, the Abrax murmured. The cow pushed again on the wire. It bent in the shape of her forehead. He'll be mad, the Abrax said. The big brown cow turned her head. She looked at the Abrax with eyes brightened by the sun glinting off mucus. She was a pretty cow. Behind the Abrax steer, a scraggly oak scraped its way upward out of the soil. Its branches lifted heavenward as if praying for survival. Acorns littered the ground around its base in a rather vain attempt at reproduction. Behind the tree, the field sloped upward toward a farmhouse, red, solid, square, nothing of a surprise. A white banister even encased the front porch. A screen door slammed shut and a woman leapt down the porch stairs. Brown paddock boots flashed from underneath her flowery sundress that billowed out behind her like a panicked sail. From the house, a man was yelling in a coarse voice that made the cow's ears twitch. A dog came bounding around the side of the house, meeting the woman as she flung open the door to a white truck that almost seemed to be patiently waiting. She scooped the dog into the truck's bed. The dog never looked back at her. The dog never looked back at the house as the woman slammed shut her door and the truck sped down the driveway, passing the field of cows. Do you like the wheat the farmer gives us? The brown cow asked. The Abrax bobbed his head. It's wheat, he said. It prickles. A fly buzzed across his barrel and his tail flicked lazily. The Aubrac had a weakness for sunlight. His eyes were closing. The brown cow flicked her tail and looked at the wheat. In the distance, a motorcycle roared along the interstate. It was the only vehicle for a few minutes until a steady progression of cars filled up the lanes. The big brown cow watched them with a flagging interest. "I feel hungry," she said to the Aubrac. He flapped an ear at a fly. He was beginning to doze again. "I feel hungry," the cow repeated, nudging the wire fence with her nose. The tan Aubrac opened his eyes. "There's grain in the barn," he said. The brown cow flicked an ear. The farmer had filled their troughs the night before while muttering to himself. It was late. The cattle herd slept standing, bumping into one another as they listed from side to side. The farmer dumped corn and grain into long troughs in the middle of the barn with rough, jerky movements that frightened the few calves. He had even, at one point, kicked out at a tabby kitten. She scurried away, hissing at him through the body of a limp mouse in her jaws. The troughs were still half full when the Aubrac steer and the cow plodded into the barn house. The far doors were closed, a bar thrown across the middle. The tan Aubrac and brown cow settled themselves next to the bins and began to eat, a repetitive munching sound coming from the round portion of their jaws that moved as they chewed. The grain became a mushy, wet mess that they swallowed. The tan Aubrac used his tongue to massage the fibers of the grain along the inside of his cheeks. The cow wagged her ears as sirens approached on the interstate from the far side of the pasture, blue lights visible from the barn as they passed along the wheatgrass field. As the lights disappeared on one side of the oak tree, the big brown cow noticed the farmer walking past the open door of the barn. He carried a length of rope looped over his shoulder, a step stool in his other hand. The cow followed the blue lights of the distant cars with her eyes, turning her head to watch them disappear as they crested a hill. She regurgitated what she had just swallowed to chew the cud more. The farmer was down near the tree now, tossing an end of the rope over a branch above his head. "I still feel pretty," she said to the tan Aubrac that had his wet nose buried in grain. Particles of food stuck to the mucus lining his nose. He bobbed his head in agreement, though he seemed to wish the brown cow would be quiet while he ate. The farmer, as he stepped off the top of the stool, swung from his neck in the air, his legs jerking. The branch above him dipped slightly but held. The rope was taut and swung back and forth as a pendulum. The brown cow and the tan Aubrac watched from the opening of the barn as people in blue uniforms, the color of the farmer's overalls, swarmed to the pasture. Upon reaching the farmer's body, two of them supported his legs as one was able to climb the stool and cut the rope. The gate is open, the cow said to the Aubrac, whose eyes were closed as he chewed. When he did not respond, she left him to eat and wandered through the open gate. She approached the cars in the farmer's yard where they sat, sirens screaming and doors open. Hating the sound they made, she began galloping down the driveway toward the wheatgrass field beyond the fence. Thank you.
My neighbor and best friend stood in front of me. Our parents were saying goodbye. Of course they would call, and we would come visit. But Elijah and I both refused to say that horrible, terrible word. Instead, he put his arms around me, without taking one step, he wouldn't take close to close the gap between us. And I put my arms around him, and we stood there leaning on each other for a long time. I never saw Elijah cry. When he was upset, his face would just crumple. The space between his eyebrows, short and half, his mouth turned down in its corners, and his eyelids looked as if they had weights attached to them, barely open enough for me to see his bright blue eyes. When he was really sad, his chin would tremble slightly. His chin was trembling that day. On impulse, I had to come to a stuffed dog I'd been clutching. It was old and limp, and stumbling was missing when my real dog got to it. But Elijah accepted it. He turned his pocket and hit his favorite hot wheels car. The faded blue one blew one purple stripe stern missing wheel. And I cradled it in my hand was like it was the most valuable thing in the world. Once I was in total seat in our car, I contorted my body like cars that could look out the back window at my friend. He was waving a little stuffed dog in the air, and his backside started whacking slightly. But I didn't wave. I stared out the window when he was telling me the tiniest we used to watch together. We were always so impressed and proud that they could follow each other in such straight lines, and everything, and everything were bigger than they were. It was the last time I would see him, although I didn't really know that until time and time cried like I did. My parents tried to get me to get my phone off and playing my favorite music. There were no doubt I'd fall asleep. I stayed awake for a minute, and it was a long hour of our life, listening to my little sister quietly beside me. She was only three, not old enough to realize what we were leaving behind. When we pulled into the driveway, we found a tiny mountain door. I was impressed in a way that only children can be, a tire swing hanging from one of the eight feet of the front yard. I told myself I would never let my parents see that I'd be there soon to sing in the same house, but I made a mental limit to come out and swing later. The rest of the house was less impressive. The backyard was just dirt and their single struggling rose and bush. The inside of the house still smelled like the old lady who had just moved out in that bedroom to my shock. Didn't even have a bed in it yet. It was just four white walls and wood floor. I collapsed onto the dusty floor, snow angel style, and started staring at the ceiling, wondering how long it would take me to walk back to Miami if I decided to run away. Salvation came in the form of our 93-year-old neighbor. Mr. Ronnie Lee knocked on our door barely an hour after we arrived. He tipped his tattered baseball cap at my dad and said a huge welcome to the neighborhood watermelon on the kitchen counter in front of my mom. He asked if he could take us fishing on the lake after we'd unpacked. My parents, ever polite, told him that we'd love to go fishing with him after we were all moved in. I, however, decided that if I was going to run away, this was perhaps my best opportunity. I begged my parents to let me go right then, and my mom finally opted to take a break from unpacking and sit on Mr. Lee's dock to watch while he and I fished from his boat on the lake. She waved at me every time I glanced in her direction. At the time, I thought she was trying to say, I'm still here, still watching, ready to catch you if you try to wander off. Looking back, she probably just didn't want me to be alone with the man we just met. As he taught me how to cast the hook out into the water and reel it back in slowly, my thoughts wandered back to the time, not a week before, when Elijah and I sat on the top bunk of his bed and used a plastic toy fishing pole to fish for Beanie Babies from the bunk below. On the rare occasions when we actually were able to catch a Beanie Baby, Elijah's whole face would light up, his smile wide enough for me to see every one of his crooked teeth, and hold up the toy like Rafiki held Simba in The Lion King. The thrill of successfully hooking a small stuffed animal on a toy pole was much different from the near terror I felt when I hooked a real fish. I felt the vibration when something, in my head it was some kind of monster, nibbled on the hook. When the bobber disappeared under the water, I nearly dropped the fishing pole, but Mr. Lee put his strong, bony hands over mine and steadied it. I noticed the scars on his hands and fingers, which I later learned were from years of baiting hooks and repairing his dock. He yanked the line to set the hook and helped me reel in the fish, which was probably at least as panicked as I was. I screamed as it flopped around my feet, and Mr. Lee laughed, his wide smile revealing his teeth, yellow and unbelievably straight. He unhooked the fish and stuck his fingers in its gills to show me what I caught. "Would you look at that," he said. "Not bad for a rookie." I didn't know what a rookie was, but I felt mildly insulted. After the initial trauma wore off, I allowed myself to touch the slimy scales and rough fins, but not before pulling back a few times, certain that it was going to jump up and bite my hand off. "Why isn't he blinking?" I asked. "You just can't believe how funny looking I am," Mr. Lee said. I looked him over and decided that I disagreed with the fish. Mr. Lee was not funny looking. He was old, but his bright blue eyes still twinkled like stars. Mr. Lee tossed the fish back into the water, and as I leaned over the side of the boat to watch it swim away, he grabbed the back of my life vest protectively. After a few more successful casts, at my insistence, Mr. Lee threw every single fish he caught back into the water. He docked the boat, and I jumped into my mom's arms. I decided I wouldn't run away that day after all. Next time I'll show you how to clean them, he said. Of course, I would later be horrified when I found out what cleaning a fish entailed. One day after a fishing trip, without warning me first, he would slap a fish onto a wood block outside his house and bring his hatchet down on its head. From then on, every time we got off his boat after a day of fishing, he would try to hand me the hatchet. I would refuse to even touch it, and he would laugh. My mom began walking home with me slumped in her arms. I waved goodbye to Mr. Lee from over her shoulder, and he tipped his hat again and disappeared inside his house, the house that would soon become my second home. I would learn to play skip-bo in that house with Mr. Lee and his wife, Anna Mae. My whole family, even my cat, would take refuge there during the hurricanes of 2005. We would watch the massive pine tree across the street fall and take the power lines with it. Mr. Lee would beat me at skip-bo, even with the gale rattling his windows, even by candlelight. When we got back home, my dad was inside blowing up an air mattress for me to sleep on that night. It made noise every time I moved, and it took me a long time to fall asleep. But when I woke up, my bed was in my room. I made my way through the rest of the house, seeing my dad's paintings on the wall and our ugly abstract rug in the office. I saw my favorite red grasshopper chair, complete with spit-up stain, sitting in the living room. And as I approached it from behind, I saw the familiar tattered baseball cap. Mr. Lee was sitting there, chatting with my parents. "Morning," Mr. Lee said as I climbed onto my mom's lap. "That's mine," I said, pointing to the spit-up stain, which was just visible above Mr. Lee's shoulder. I was not joking, but they all laughed. Mr. Lee could not jump rope with me or race with me in the swimming pool like Elijah could, but he seemed impressed when I showed him how the ants in my front yard walked in straight lines and carried things that were bigger than they were. Last Thanksgiving, we went to Miami to visit our family and drove past our old house. It had been torn down, and a bigger one was being built in its place. A house without the tiled front steps my dad made, without the boulder we sat on to take Christmas card pictures every year, without the crooked knocker on the front door and the handprints I made when I accidentally touched the fresh paint on the walls. Elijah's house still looked the same, except for the for sale sign planted in the front yard. To my surprise, I wasn't upset about our old house. It had been erased, along with any trace that my family had ever lived there, but it wasn't what was gone that upset me. It was what was never there in the first place. The man who baptized both me and my dad at his dock. The man who set off fireworks from the lake every 4th of July, even when it made his wife nervous, even when my dad offered to do it instead. The man who took me fishing every weekend until the weekend he passed away at 98 years old. The man with bright blue eyes and scarred hands. Thank you.
All right, so first of all, before we clap for everyone, can we get another round of applause for the undergraduates who read? Yes. Amazing, right? Beautiful. So one time I'm not joking, okay? But all right, let's get a round of applause for all the winners tonight. All right, I'm alone. Before you go, a few requests. First of all, any cups and garbage, if you could bring it out there so that I don't have to do it. I'm lazy. Number two, if you could blow out your candles so I don't get incinerated after you leave, that'd be great. And next week we will have Kate Marvin reading here. Whoop whoop. Okay. Whoop whoop. Alright, whatever. But it's great. You should really come. It'll be wonderful. I want to see you again, here, not out. I'm not creepy, I promise. I hope you guys have a wonderful night. Thank you. Goodbye.